Hello, good afternoon, and a very warm welcome to today's episode of I am going to start today with a piece which at the head of its score has the no-nonsense marking of Il tutto vivace, fantastico, con energia, capriccio e sentimento. Expressions such as spiccatissimo, energicissimo, con fuoco, are scattered throughout the opening pages. So clearly, this is not a piece that is backward in coming forward, at least not at the beginning. Things are not as clear-cut as they first seem, however. After a few minutes thrashing about, things come to a halt, and we enter a new terrain, which is marked in the score by the words lento, occulto, andante tranquillo. The seeming assuredness with which this wonderfully maverick piece set out becomes ever more a mirage. It loses its way, but happily so, an enchanted victim of its own curiosity, and ultimately seems to revel in its growing uncertainty, right up to its abrupt end, which is a march that can't be bothered to obediently put one foot in front of the other, and strangely peters out. The composer, on this evidence, was no longer willing to follow the beat of anyone's drum except his own. One of the pieces most typically associated with the piano is the nocturne, but our next piece for today is a symphonic nocturne. The two pieces we have heard today were both composed in 1912 and by the same composer, Ferruccio Busoni. Busoni, when he was alive, was a very important figure in the musical world, both as teacher and theoretician, and he maintained friendships and voluminous correspondence with many of his greatest musical peers. Since his death, however, the musical world has cast him into oblivion for being guilty of not fitting easily into any obvious category. Too German to be considered a true Italian, too Italian to be a stereotypical German, too traditional to be radical, too radical to be traditional, too great a pianist to be deemed a truly great composer, just too damned original, authentic, an individual for his own good. And so he is best left to gather dust on the shelf. That was the opening of Die glückliche Hand, composed by Arnold Schönberg between 1910 and 1913. It is a piece for voices and orchestra, but it is not an opera in the usual sense of the word. Schönberg himself called it simply a drama with music. But that is as far as simplicity goes in reference to this piece. Let's start with the facts. It is a piece in four scenes that last about 20 minutes, and with that we come to the end of the facts. One of the principal reasons why I will almost certainly go to my grave without ever experiencing this piece live, or at least in the way Schönberg wanted it to be performed, is that it calls for extensive and extremely intricate coloured lighting effects. Reading the stage instructions is like reading a description of works by Kandinsky painted during this period, and I don't think it is at all coincidental that the one and only Almanac of Der Blaue Reiter was published during the composition of Die glückliche Hand. Indeed, Schönberg's score for Herzgewächse, of which I played a recording in last week's programme, formed an integral part of that singular publication. It is a strange looking score, as there are numerous paragraphs scattered among the bars. These are the aforementioned descriptions of the various light and stage settings in the four scenes, and they are far more verbose than anything spoken or sung in the piece. The actual text is starkly laconic in comparison. The exact and exacting stage instructions, the minimal speech, the importance of gesture, and the dishevelled, haggard appearance of the unnamed main protagonist can't help but make one think of Beckett. But it is worth remembering, for context's sake, that when Schönberg composed this music and wrote the words, Sam Beckett was a young boy in short trousers, probably already fuming at the pointlessness of existence and the inability of words to express anything worth expressing while swanning around South County Dublin. Die glückliche Hand is a work replete with symbolism. What those symbols mean is open to limitless interpretation, and what follows is just one and just one man's take on what it might all mean. It is a cyclical work in four scenes. Another one-movement symphony? Who's to say? The first scene opens with the man, as he is uniquely referred to throughout, flat on his face with some creature seemingly feeding on his flesh. If that weren't enough, he is being simultaneously chastised by a group of six women and a separate group of six men. They seem to find him wanting for his longing for the tawdry things of this world, namely recognition and success in the frivolous sense, not to mention the pleasures of Eros. Rather than devoting himself to cultivating his divine artistic gift, wherein lies the only thing worthwhile or that can be considered success. They likewise lambast him for his inability to learn and for his repeating the same mistakes. From this, maybe, we can view the monkey on his back, as it were, as his own ego and sense of pride as an artist, demanding plaudits and respect in the face of his hostile public and peers. Is this Schoenberg's version of making poetry out of a quarrel with himself? Is the chorus that finds him so wanting his own conscience? In the second scene, a beautiful woman appears on the stage, which causes the man to burst into rapturous poetry. The most telling thing about this scene for me is to be found in the stage descriptions which state, Der Mann darf nie zu ihr hinsehen. Blickt immer nach vorn. The man must never look at her. He always looks forward. I take two things from this. As I have talked about before when discussing Schoenberg and his works of this period, his need as an artist to go forward, never looking back, he felt to be his destiny, an inner compulsion, which could not be denied, as he said himself. But secondly, although he never looked back, he could not deny his past, especially not the joys and traumas he had lived through with his first wife. And these emotions and memories would remain a well he would draw on in the forging of his new art. It could also imply that what he thinks of the woman is based on his feelings of love rather than as she actually appears and behaves in reality. The setting of the third scene in A Smith's Forge can't help but suggest Wagner's Siegfried reforging of the sword Nothung. The man watches several workers tinkering away and says with wonderful German succinctness, Das kann man einfacher. That can be done more simply. He steps into the forge and, ignoring the threats and jeers of the other smiths, picks up a hammer, Thor-like, and brings it down on a piece of gold. With one mighty blow, he destroys the anvil, and his piece of gold is magically transformed into a bejeweled crown. With typical terseness, the man utters, So schafft man Schmuck. That's how you make jewelry. He likewise does all this without any silly Siegfried-esque ho-hos or ho-hays. It is almost impossible not to see in this scene Schoenberg's relationship to Wagner, or Wagner's music, at least. He seems to be saying, listen, Dick, stop messing about with chromaticism and tinkering with tonality. The only thing to do is just to smash tonality to pieces forever. This is followed by the most extensive series of colour transformations in the piece, which may be interpreted as the welter of emotions caused by the woman and her betrayal and abandonment of the man, or it could be a metaphor for the wealth of magical sounds released by the smashing of tonality. At the end of the scene, the woman hurls a slab of stone on top of the man, and the fourth and final scene brings us back to where we started in the first scene, with the same music, and with the stone now in the form of the vampire-like creature sucking the life out of the man. We also return to the chastising chorus of men and women now together, still berating the man. This is an enormously, fascinatingly enigmatic work, and I have only touched on some of its content and context. I don't know if there is one overriding meaning to this work, probably the most ignored of Schoenberg's extraordinary pieces of this period. But at the close of the piece, the chorus are admonishing him for his continued search, even though all it has brought him and will only ever bring him, according to them, is pain and suffering. I mentioned Beckett at the start of this piece, but the ending reminds me of his elder compatriot Yeats, particularly one of his very last poems. Arguably the most important gesture in Die glückliche Hand is the fleeting touching of hands between the man and the woman. Schoenberg, despite his dedication to his craft, his intellectual pursuit and artistic destiny, is still starved for the bosom of his fairy bride. Notwithstanding the pain it brings, he seems to want to state the sanctity of the sensuous and underline the fact that all art is forged in the fire of flesh and blood. The emotional blows that hammer down upon us are absorbed on the anvil of our souls. The foul rag and bone shop of the heart is the heart of his art. It seems wholly opposite that I find, today at least, I may change my mind tomorrow, Die glückliche Hand, Schoenberg's singularly most sensuous and seductive score, possibly his best kept secret. And that's all I have for today, so thank you very much for listening, and I hope you will tune in again next time for some more
Resounding Echoes.